Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the...
Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You are Locked On Celtics, your daily Celtics podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.
I'm so hyped right now. Anything's possible.
Oh, my mama. Oh, my mama made it, man. Anything's possible.
Rainy days. Jump shot fade away. This the best Celtics podcast day to day, especially when the season get hectic. I stay waiting on it like receiving a Nets pick. Nothing like the terrible analysts on the TV. So in depth, you might even hear a story on Gigi. So in depth, they might do an hour about the D-League. So in depth, you probably should pay him, but it's a freebie. Yeah, John Corrales and Jay King. Locked on, trying to get the 18th ring. So you can miss me with the blah blah. No more Geno time, we watching Jay do the Zaza. Melis.
Hey there, welcome back to the Locked On Celtics podcast here on the Locked On Podcast Network. I am John Corrales, thanking you for making us part of your daily routine Monday through Friday. You're here with us, we're here with you. Thank you for downloading. This is the Friday show, and this Friday show is going to be a great one with radio play-by-play voice, Sean Grandy. I want to thank you for downloading again. Thank you for subscribing to the show. If you are not a subscriber, however you got here, there's got to be a way to subscribe. But if you are just finding your way to the show, search for us, Locked On Celtics, on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, wherever it is podcasts are available, we are there. Go to our Audioboom page. There's an RSS feed if you want to plug us into something. Follow us on Twitter at Rainin_Jays. Make sure there's no G. You can tweet us with the hashtag RaininJays and talk to us during games. Today's show, Sean Grandy, radio play-by-play voice for the Boston Celtics. We're going to talk about a lot. We'll get into Isaiah Thomas, who I've never seen anything like Isaiah Thomas before. And even in all of my time, and I may predate a lot of you when it comes to watching the Celtics, nothing like this. I've seen some awesome, amazing Hall of Fame performances from players who are, in the grand scheme of things, much better. Like Larry Bird is much better than Isaiah Thomas, but Isaiah Thomas's fourth quarters have been just unbelievable, in my opinion. So I need to get perspective from Sean, who will at least give me an idea of whether I'm off, or I don't know, maybe I'm just remembering it wrong. We'll get into that. We'll get into the evolution of the game, the way this game has turned into such a three-point heavy thing, and how we got here, and how some of the previous Celtics coaches, some that we might not want to mention, really were on the forefront of this, and how Tommy Heinsohn, I think, is really one of the true pioneers of small ball. And if the three-point line existed back then, he would have just been just crazy with it. I guarantee he would have been crazy with it. And, of course, the big topic, Sunday, Super Bowl Sunday. The appetizer on Super Bowl Sunday is Paul Pierce's return to Boston for the final time as an NBA player. Paul Pierce and the Clippers coming to Boston, and we have a long history with Paul Pierce to get into. So let's get right into it. Let's welcome in our guest, Sean Grandy, radio play-by-play voice for the Boston Celtics. Sean, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Not a problem. You know, Jay King, I feel sorry for the kid sometimes. He tries so hard, just trying to, you know, he's just trying to catch on. Nobody really likes him down at the Garden. It's, you know, it's a lonely existence for him. So when he reaches out, I feel like it's the least I can do from my position, you know, way up high.
Yeah.
My, you know, exalted throne to throw the kid a bone.
Yeah. Now, this is what's going to earn you one of those Heroes Among Us awards.
Yeah, but it really is. I mean, I don't want to say the word charity when I think of him, and yet it's sort of what comes to mind. So
yeah, no, it's I appreciate that. As a guy who has to carry him on a regular basis, I feel what you're saying. But, I feel like we have like a little bit of a kindred kind of thing going on here because of that. So
yeah, he's like that dog that everyone sort of takes care of a little bit. Like,
yeah. You lay out some scraps, you throw out some water. He gets by, everybody loves him, but really. Okay. So we'll do our thing. Let's a couple of topics that are front and center. We just got to get into this Isaiah Thomas thing. Because I, in my giddiness, I sit there and I say, I've never seen fourth quarters like this before. Knowing full well that we as Boston Celtics aficionados have seen fourth quarter clutch performances. But like this, though, really, this seems like it's different.
It is different, and it's not just the way in which he's doing it. It's also the fact that it's funny, very few people have sort of come back at us, come back at me, and come back at Max with, hey, Larry Bird did this all the time. Well, he did it all the time when you watch a YouTube clip, because they're all spliced together as if they happened in consecutive games, which this is actually really happening in real time. And I'm pretty sure, I've never seen them standing side by side, but I believe Larry was about a foot taller than Isaiah. So what we are seeing is something that we had never seen before on a variety of levels. I think back in December, mid-December, right around there when he first came back, I started using the name Iverson a lot. And I've stopped because Iverson didn't do this. This hasn't been done, what we're seeing. And as I've said a million times, the hardest thing we do in my line of work is taking the cards of what we're seeing in front of us and trying to shuffle them in real time into the deck of history, because you need really years to appreciate. I don't think we truly appreciate. I tried during 2007-08. I remember doing a lot of those games with my palms up like Jordan in the 92 finals. Like, this is, that was a different thing because I kind of had, there was the whole division there with the Garnett thing, which everybody else, all my other colleagues were against that trade, if you remember back then. So for me, it was sort of this down goes Frazier, told you so. But I was also trying to get everyone to appreciate how historically good. Like, I don't know if they're going to win the championship. I thought they were going to in 08. I don't know how many championships there will be. But understand that what's happening here, at the time, only the Jordan Bulls had done. Golden State's now doing it 2 or 3 years in a row. But what the Celtics did in 08, nobody had done that except for a Jordan team in like 35 years. So you want people to appreciate it as it's going on. And the same thing, is happening now. And it is no longer an NBA team. This is a Broadway show right now at the Garden. People know the ending. They know exactly how it's going to turn out, and yet they want to be there to see the star belt out that finale. And he's doing it over and over again. It's like a rerun.
It's ridiculous to watch because you don't think he's going to do it again in quite that way. You're like, he can't. Not 20 points in a quarter again. He keeps scoring. Lately, you had the statistic, and you want to make. I want to make sure you get it exactly right. Since his return, it's been averaging 13 points per fourth quarter.
Yeah. Yep. 33 a game, 13 in the fourth.
That's ridiculous. I can't even.
He's the leading scorer in the league. Period. And then you throw in those the fourth quarters.
So
on top of it, he's outscoring teams. For like 7-8 minute stretches at the end of games.
So, okay. So now we know his size and blah, blah, blah. Are we looking at this the wrong way? Are we looking at this? We're saying despite his size, he's doing this and that. What about because of his size? He's able to get low. He's able to kind of push off without getting caught. He's able to use other players' momentum against them, get below their center of gravity and bounce off of them in clear space.
And off and not get called for it.
Yeah.
Because now he's a superstar. Yeah. All that stuff is true. All that stuff is happening. Iverson learned how to play that way. All the great players who were smaller learned how there were things for all the obvious things against them. There were things for them. It's just that nobody else has had this skill set. And I think, as we talk now on the 2nd of February, he had... And I use the Iverson example comes into play with 2001, in that the Sixers had put the perfect team around Iverson, with Eric Snow, with Ratliff. You're the perfect guys to complement. And I think the Celtics as a team, you have, listen, if you're going to have Isaiah doing what he's doing, the dirty little secret of everything that's happening here is that Isaiah scoring 13 a game in the fourth quarter, he's given up 12. Defensively, it's really, you know, these games aren't games that where the Celtics are down by 15 going into the fourth and winning. They're games that they're ahead by three going to the fourth and they win by three. I mean, there's no, you know, that's, again, the dirty little secret of it is how bad the Celtics have been defensively in these quarters. But the offense, and it's sort of the big picture of the team right now at this snapshot of the season, is that the offense has been so good. Celtics had, what, that 20, you know, I'm making up the game number, but there was about a 20-game run where the Celtics were among the three or four worst defensive teams in the league, and they went 14-6 or whatever in those 20 games, which is ridiculous. That should not happen. But it has, because we're in the sort of, you know, in the new NBA where, you know, Charles Barkley, who I couldn't have more respect for in the world, kept coming out last year saying, hey, Golden State's not going to win. They're not going to get to the finals. Somebody's going to beat them, you know, the last couple of years, because of the way that's old thinking. Because in the old days, you couldn't win like that. It's not the old days anymore. The entire game has changed. Historic numbers. It's not just Isaiah doing it. You know, Westbrook and Harden. There are crazy stat lines we're seeing all over the league. And I think sometimes you have to recognize when you're in 1961 in baseball, or you're in a, you know, you're in the live puck era, you're in the 80s in the NHL, things are changing. And you can't look sometimes. History is a great judge. It's important to know it. But sometimes history isn't going to repeat because it's everything around us is completely different.
So let's get into this whole new NBA thing. Why didn't somebody realize this earlier that, you know, if you shoot 35% from three, you have to shoot 50% from two to match that? Is it because in the 80s or when the three-point line came around that people were shooting 50% from two, so it didn't matter? And now that we've evolved, the mid-range jumper has just become so de-emphasized that guys aren't focusing on that and they're not shooting as well? Or is it just because no one noticed that, hey, wait a second, the numbers work out, we should focus on the three more? Hey, Larry Bird, you should be shooting a lot more threes.
Hey, guess who thought that? Rick Pitino and Jim O'Brien thought that. But they didn't have what most coaches in the NBA have now, which is 6, 7, 8 guys that can hit that shot with regularity. You know, Antoine Walker and Paul Pierce set records, you know, in 02 and 03 back in that time, once Jim O'Brien let him off the leash. But they weren't shooting that percentage. They weren't that, you know, they weren't that good. Now, every night you seem to go into a city, and I'm having a conversation with Brad Stevens about how the team on the other side, everybody can shoot the three. And it happens a lot. You know, there are a lot of teams like that that just have, you know, come up in this era where that was a big, you know, we talked about, who's the guy we talked about? Oh, Jason Smith, who we saw last week. And Jason Smith comes in the league 7, 8 years ago, and we're like, well, he's a 7-footer, and he steps out and he shoots. And he's not, what kind of player is he didn't fit in. You know, he was an anachronism in 2008 or whenever when he first came into the league. It's one of the reasons that I was not – it's, you have to be – when I say I don't like a player, it's in the Matthew Berry fantasy sense of not like – meaning I don't like this player as much as other people do. Kevin Love is a really good player. I never liked him in all these trade conversations. People were always disappointed when I said it, that I don't like him as much as other people do, because when Kevin Love first burst on the scene, nobody else could do that. Now, like, everybody can do it. So it's not as, you know, his skill set is easier to find than it was. He's still, you know, he's a very good player. He's a special player, all those things. But he's not that rare one out of 100 diamond anymore in the NBA. And that's the point, that the game is, that's how, in many ways, you know, the game has evolved.
Yeah, and really, when you talk about coaches who had this, Tommy Heinsohn back in the 70s was the small ball pioneer. I bet you if they had a 3-point line, he would have figured this out. And people sell Tommy short a lot.
He would have played it, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, look, Tommy is who Tommy is now. Tommy is obviously a Hall of Fame player. He's a Hall of Fame coach, I think he's a Hall of Fame broadcaster. There's no definition.
And you know, the broadcasting. Yeah, listen, it's funny, Mike Orman and I had an interesting conversation about this the other day, how our relationship now, which is 16 years old, and we've been through, you know, divorces together and kids together, and his daughter, you know, who I knew when she was in high school, just got engaged, and all these different things. But we don't know each other's, we don't know each other really, our work. I probably know his a little more because sometimes the games are on replay, like when we get home at 2 a.m. from wherever we were. Sometimes I'll watch the last few minutes of the game, but we really don't know each other and the content of our work. So I'm not watching every telecast. But Tommy is, you know, to a whole generation, Tommy is just this, he is the personification. He's the carryover of Johnny Most. That is what he is to an entire, you know, a generation of Celtic fans. So, yeah, he was a great player who, boy, he would have loved to be in that era, you know, where he just shoot the ball. He did shoot the ball. He was way ahead of his time. He constantly shot. He shot like 32%, and he just shot from everywhere whenever he felt like. He called him Tommy Gunn for a reason. But he was a coach who thought the game through. It always boggles my mind how young he was when he coached his last game. You know, he was like Brad Stevens' age. Imagine if Brad Stevens stopped coaching and never coached again.
That's insane.
That's basically Tommy. You know, you got to think about that. Tommy was, I don't have the exact thing in front of me, but he was, what, 43 maybe? 40, he was a couple of years older, but he was close to my age when he stopped coaching. And that was 40, you know, I always tell Max, you know, Max got him fired. That was Max's rookie year. and, you know, that was, and never coached again. It's amazing.
Well, I mean, he just comes from such a different time that here's a guy who was rookie of the year and Hall of Famer, and in between his Hall of Fame playing career and his Hall of Fame coaching career, he was selling insurance. So that's, and he had to debate whether he wanted to stop because he was in a pretty good insurance manager training program. He's like, all right, fine, I'll go coach because Red asked me to. Like, that's just crazy. But it's such a digression. But he was a pioneer of the small ball era, and there's no doubt in my mind that if he had the three-point line, he would have realized, shit, go shoot the three. You get more points for that, and you don't have to hit as many to get as many points. But
the argument against it is always, and this is the Max argument for years because it's taken him many, many years to get on board, was about getting other teams in foul trouble, getting the ball inside, making sure you score, and the foul, you know, the foul difficulty. But again, that becomes a two-way street. If both teams are playing that way, you have to be able to play the way the best team plays if you're going to have a chance to be among the elites. That's the argument against it.
That's a fair point, but this is where I give Tommy a ton of credit. And for all of his blusteriness and blah, blah, blah during the game, he makes, if you listen, he makes some great points. There are points at the in the fourth quarters of games where the Celtics, who are now one of the preeminent gunning three-point teams in the league, he will get on stretches where he says, take it to the basket. Forget the three-point three-point shot right now. Take it to the hole. They're expecting the three. Get to the hole. Draw some fouls because – and it's situational. And – there's no blanket strategy in the NBA or any sport. So I want to give Tommy all of the credit in the world for understanding. He's never been hypercritical of the three at all. So every once in a while he drops in that, you know, they're settling, but there are times at the ends of games where he understands, because he's an amazing basketball mind, that if you settle for the three and instead of taking it into the – You at least keep the defense on their toes, one, and B, or two, one, B, two, what? You put them in foul trouble, and then you put them in the bonus a little bit down the stretch, and that's where an Isaiah Thomas can really take over, bringing it back to the Isaiah Thomas conversation. When Isaiah has his 20-point fourth quarters, he's getting to the line a ton. So if you are a little more selective when you're shooting the three, and you get to the line a little bit, you force the issue and you force some fouls, then you give it to Isaiah Thomas, and it's not just standing and watching, and now you have an opportunity to really pull away in the fourth quarter.
You know how often I've had, like, Max loses when Amir Johnson or Kelly or somebody is under the basket and they kick out to the corner or the wing? I mean, I have to hold on to Max because he's just he loses his mind. And, right, you know, you can understand. There have been times, I mean, the emphasis is important, but there are times that it does go – there are times that you say, oh, my God, that was a layup. That was a layup opportunity or a foul opportunity, and you just, you know.
He must lose his mind, and I bridge the gap.
He does.
in like 3-on-2, 2-on-1 situations, 3-on-2 mostly, when guys, instead of cutting to the basket, flare out to the corners, how long did it take Max to sit there and say, why the hell are they doing this? How long did it take him to get into the, like, all right, I kind of get it now? Or does he still not get it?
He hasn't yet.
He hasn't. It's such an old school mentality.
I mean, you know, he's evolved, but not to the point where, like, giving up a hill. I don't think, you know, he will ever get to the point where he's okay with, like, giving up the layups or giving up, like, under the basket out to the corner. It'll wrap.
Well, I mean, the game has changed a lot, and there's always going to be at times like this a bit of a transition, and some guys just not going to, you know, Charles Barkley, like you mentioned. Whatever, like, I used to believe, like, a jump shooting team, like those old school Phoenix Suns, the D'Antoni Phoenix Suns, just too much of a jump shooting team when you get to the playoffs and whatever. But times have changed, so you don't have that now. A guy that bridges that in the NBA is Paul Pierce, and Paul Pierce has this look. Let's just bring it. Paul Pierce on Sunday is going to play his final game in the Boston Garden. Just from where you sit and all of the games that you have watched, this game with his role with the Clippers, is it as meaningful as his first return as a Brooklyn Net? Is it as meaningful as some of the other, like, where does this game sit for you? Where do you think it sits for fans?
I think it's up there. I think when I first saw it, I mean, when the schedule first came out in August, I certainly knew there was a chance the Patriots would be playing, you know, that night. And as we approach it now, as we're hours away from it, the Patriots have pulled a lot away from this week. I mean, think about if Isaiah has this week he has, and Paul comes back and it's next week instead of this week. Isaiah is leaving SportsCenter this week. The entire world isn't in Houston. It's just the way it worked out. So I think the Super Bowl pulls a little bit away from it. Obviously, just the sex appeal of the Clippers and Doc coming back and it being a national game on Super Bowl Sunday. There's a lot of that. I think it's a little preview of what will be certainly a very special standalone night when Paul Pierce night finally happens. It's funny, every time I tweet about or talk about this being the last game, you probably wouldn't be surprised, but there is a significant portion of Celtics Nation that has bought into this notion that somehow through facilitating a Carmelo, through some way, shape, or form, that Paul Pierce is going to end up here at the trade deadline, you know, in some, you know, to finish his career here. So there's a lot of people pushing back at me when I say this is Paul Pierce's last game in Boston. They're like, what if he comes here in the trade? What if he finishes his career? He should finish his career here. What if that happens? So there's certainly a lot of that out there. But I think people are really enjoying what's going on now. I think in 13, nobody wanted to look at what was happening on the court. You know, so it was, oh my God, Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett are here. This is awesome. Now, the Paul Pierce last game in Boston is in some ways the biggest thing going on, but you also have a team that is now in 2013, the Celtics were a 25-win team, and they were just worse than that. The last two-thirds of that year were just horrific. Now, as I tweeted last night, the Celtics in the last 2 years, this isn't 2 weeks or 2 months, in the last two full years, from the minute Pete Carroll decided to throw on second and goal and stand down Marshawn Lynch four times, from that moment forward, the Celtics aren't the 25th best team in the NBA anymore. They're not the 15th best team. They're not the 10th best team. The Celtics are the 6th best team in the NBA. 6 out of 30 over the last 2 years. So I think people are starting, especially after the win over Toronto, starting to catch on to the fact that it really could be, maybe it won't be, but it certainly could be a long playoff run now with the sex appeal of Isaiah doing what he's doing. And Paul Pierce now is, I mean, there's a very legitimate chance that the Celtics could outlast the Clippers in the playoffs.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was the first year when the Spurs got swept or whatever. The Celtics actually lasted. Like in 2015, the Celtics like lasted longer than the Spurs did in the playoffs. Some crazy stat like that. But that certainly exists. So I think the Patriots take something away from it. The Celtics being as good as they are, or as relevant, I guess is a better way to phrase it, because how good this team is, I'm not, you know, the Celtics are winning a lot of close games, which they didn't last year. This is a number that hit me the other night. The Celtics last year lost that game in New York in January. They dropped to 19-19 on the year. At that point, even though they were 19-19, they have a better scoring differential than they did than they do now when they are 31-18. So when that Knicks game happened a couple of weeks ago, when some of these other games happened, I think when the Knicks game ended, I said flat out at the end of the game, which is what differentiates us from Mike and Tommy in so many ways, they had it coming. I mean, the Celtics had a game like that coming. They've been fortunate. The record is great, but they've been fortunate on several occasions to win some of these games, given how close, you know, so when every game seems to be a one-possession game, and the Celtics now have won more of those than they've lost. So is this team better than last year's team? I think when they're healthy, they are, but they haven't been, you know, they haven't been healthy. So I don't think they've outperformed last year's team yet. But I've said from the beginning of the year, everyone thought this was going to be a big jump forward. 56, 58 wins, every interview, every conversation like this I had, I said, I don't want to rain anybody's parade. I don't see the win total going up that much. I thought it was going to be in that 48-51 range, but I do think the Celtics will win a playoff series, and I think it's fair to characterize this year as a disappointment if they don't. But is this team better than last year's team? Not yet. Not yet.
Not yet. Even with Al Horford.
Well, they're not. I mean, with the Al Horford team, with everybody playing, has been. But that's happened 22 times out of tomorrow's the 50th game. And we've only seen that team 22 times. And I think there's a natural assumption when that happens to say, yeah, but when they're healthy, they'll be great. Are you ready? Is anybody listening ready to guarantee that everybody's going to be healthy and ready to go on April 16th when the playoffs begin? Because, this, you know, on the one hand, it's easy to say, hey, when they're healthy, they're great. On the other hand, at some point, it becomes no longer a coincidence that you've only had 22 out of 50 games with everybody healthy, and you went into the playoffs last year, and you saw what happened without Avery Bradley after the Celtics got victimized by the electoral math of the four-way tiebreak. You know.
That's a great way to put it.
Well, that was all I could think of last year. Well, the Hawks, by the way, I don't know when everybody's hearing this. I literally, writing my chart for the Friday game, when we began this conversation, Atlanta was down 15 or 16 points in the fourth quarter at Houston, and I wrote in their record in my standings chart with a loss in that game to Houston, and they came back and they came from like 16 down to win in Houston in the fourth quarter. So it annoys me when I have to cross something out in my chart. But that's another thing that's going on, another dirty little secret. Everyone's very excited that the Celtics are ahead of Toronto, and that's great. The Celtics are still closer to fifth than they are to first in the East because Washington and Atlanta are galloping on the outside right now. Washington has been unbeatable, and the Hawks have been right with them. We were talking about the Hawks, and they were talking about trading Millsap, and they were giving up on the year. And now you got, you know, they have, the Celtics have 31 wins, Toronto has 30, and Washington and Atlanta have 29. So 3 or 4 weeks ago, Boston and Toronto were starting to separate themselves from the pack. Not anymore. Now it's a four-way dance, 2 through 5.
Yeah, what the hell happened with Atlanta? We thought trading Korver was a stupid move. They gave Korver away. And we thought, oh, well, here comes the fire sale. And it turns out trading Korver, I don't want to say this is a direct correlation, but holy shit, they just went on a huge run. They're like, they're right there.
Yeah, Dwight Howard's been better than, you know, we've seen the worst of Dwight Howard. But, boy, he found a reason to play tonight. He had a crazy night, you know, going back to Houston for the first time. I think he had a 20-20 game, and that's a monster comeback. I mean, Houston obviously is really, really good. And for Atlanta to go in there and be down, whatever they were down, 16-17 in the fourth quarter, win that game. So it's been a really fun year for the NBA, though. In a year, ironically, in which there's never been less suspense about how the 30 teams, the two that are going to be left, it's been from the beginning to end, nobody thinks anybody other than Golden State or Cleveland is going to be in the finals yet. It's been a fascinating year, and it's going to be a fascinating run to see who gets there, even if it does end up being Super Fight 3. And my only experience in the NBA has been when everyone assumes that something is going to happen, it doesn't. So who knows?
Right. Well, and that's a great point to bring up, because let's just go with it's a foregone conclusion that Golden State and Cleveland are going to meet. I think everybody kind of agrees with that. This is still a lot of fun. People say, why bother playing the season? Well, shit, I've been sitting here watching these games all year long, and I'm having a whole lot of fun watching these games.
Yeah, I deeply reject. I mean, listen, if, and again, you get that sometimes in Boston. Well, the Celtics, they haven't beaten any. You know, I get that. You get that pushback. It's funny because I love going on like with Mike Felger and stuff like that because there's this, you know, that's the only thing that saves my job because obviously I'm the anti-homer in so many ways. And yet when you say something like the Celtics have the sixth best record, you guys realize that over the last 2 years, people say, well, they still can't beat Cleveland. They're still going to win a championship. 2 years ago, they were 41-87 under Brad Stevens. 2 years later, we're having conversations like this. We're having conversations as Isaiah Thomas, an MVP candidate, which, by the way, in a year, and if you're not counting defense, he is, and in a year in which James Harden is the front runner, I think it's fair to say that defense is out the window when we're talking about MVP. We're talking about guys like, you know, Steph Curry and James Harden and Isaiah Thomas. Of course, he's in that conversation. But if winning the championship or bust is your only enjoyment of professional sports, and not the pursuit of it or the pursuit of excellence or the pursuit of getting better. I mean, you're going to win once every 30 years, and the NBA less than that, because when somebody gets LeBron James, they're going to win titles and be in the finals every year. So if you can't get on board, if you don't enjoy this ride, I remember when the Celtics, when people wanted them to lose, and they'd win these crazy games in Washington, and Phil Pressey would hit 5-3. You get the pushback, right? Jeff Green hit the game winner in Miami. And it got to the point where I would say, if you're not excited as a Celtics fan for a game like this, I do not know what to tell you. I don't know what to tell you if that is your, you know, if that's your standard and whatever. And I say the same thing to people. It's like, well, championship or bust. Well, there's 24 other teams that marveled at the Celtics going, you know, everybody's marveled at it, but there's 24 other teams that would love to jump up in the standings and turn this around as quickly as the Celtics have. But that's not good enough for you. Again, throw my hands up. I don't know what to tell you.
Right. That's, well, I mean, some of it I think might be some bit of being spoiled. I mean, here we are,
sure,
amazingly in Boston. Now, I'm young enough to appreciate this. I'm old enough to know that this hasn't been the case. So, but as a Celtics fan, I've had this like, all right, when I first started really truly getting into Celtics basketball as a fan, I was probably about, you know, 10 years old, and that was 1983. So I was I'm lucky enough to really start my forming of being a fan at one hell of a time in Celtics history. So, but I think along with that, there were the Patino years. There was that huge downtime. And being a New England native, I had other teams at that point, the Red Sox, the Patriots, that were just kind of blah. And nowadays, a kid who's in college has no real...
You're under the age of 25. You have had a completely different experience in New England than
it's amazing
your parents had, and you can't explain it. And I started, you know, when I first came here, it was, you know, it was 1989, 1990 when I first came to college, and I worked here obviously all through the 90s until I went to, you know, went to Minnesota, went in the NBA, and it was, you know, even in the couple of years after I left, it was Loserville. You know, the Bruins were becoming irrelevant. The Celtics had been deep. When I came back, my first year back, the Celtics made the play. It had been 6 years since the Celtics had made the playoffs. 6 years and 10, I think, since they had won a first-round play. They had won a playoff series. And that's a long time for, you know, it goes by. The older you get, the years don't seem like much. But 10 years, that's a long time. And fans turning around and, you know, having different experiences. So, yeah, you got to, for the Celtics to do what they've done and basically just have 1 year out of the playoffs. If you had said the Celtics were going to have 1 year out of the playoffs, if you had said 2 years ago in the middle of year two for Brad Stevens, that team was good, that was laughable that team could make. But he got that team into the playoffs. You got to be kidding me with that. That was, and, you know, they kept losing at home and then they'd go on the road and win the next night. And they had, I think they won their last six road games that year. That was when the back-to-back road game streak started.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you got, you know, it was... It was absurd, and then people would get upset when they would lose. I mean, I'll say it here. It's all that I haven't said to Mike, but you go into the playoffs that year, And I remember thinking, this is going to be bad. This is good. This is as rough as it gets. You know, the Cavs kind of messed around with the year a little bit, but now they're clearly going to the finals. I don't know if they're going to win, but they're going to go to the finals. So I remember positioning the whole thing as, can the Celtics win? You know, if they win a game, that's their championship. You know, in 2015, can they win a game in this series? And I thought, you know, I remember, like, you know, writing stuff and writing my opens and doing interviews and positioning it that way. And then Mike, you know, goes on Comcast and is like, Celtics in six. What? And I remember saying at the time, because I had people ask me about it, I had no choice but to say, I don't know how many years that's going to be before the Celtics beat Cleveland four times, but it's going, you know, it's going to be a while. Like, it's going to be like 2.5 years before you get four wins, not a week and a half. And it was just, you know, again, that's what I mean when, like, it makes me, when you try to call it down the middle. like what in six what? What are you talking about with Celtics in six? And it would have been, I thought that, you know, I had a real chance to get that fourth game. That would have been great. The crowd was great, you know, and then Jay Crowder got elbowed in the mouth and tore his knee up and whatever. But and then last year was a disappointment, but they had the Avery Bradley injury, and again, the Celtics really got screwed by the playoff system. They should have been home to Charlotte. They were the best. They had the best record in the tiebreaker of those four teams. By that standard, they should have been the 3 seed. Instead, they ended up as the 5 seed, having to play the 3rd-best team. So, you know, that kind of stuff evens up. The Celtics certainly all have home court. And if they don't win a playoff series, I think the criticism is fair.
Well, we'll see how that all goes. I mean, there's still a lot to be done. There's a trade deadline that'll either bring somebody or won't. It's who knows what's going to happen there. But I want to get back to the Celtics fans and those under 25 people who, back to Paul Pierce. If you're under 25 and you see Paul Pierce coming back, he's a hero. He is the 2008, the guy standing on that rickety card table that 10 people were holding together so he wouldn't fall off and die, holding up that champion, that MVP trophy. But he wasn't always that in Boston. And what I'm really curious is, I'm curious about is your feeling on Paul Pierce and his place in Celtics history and Boston sports history, because he was a reclamation project as much as he was a hero.
Let's remember the several things that we had. We had the cataclysmic experience with George Karl and the national team, the world championship team with Andre Miller. It couldn't have gone worse. We had the Jacob Marley, Ebenezer Scrooge bandage wrap after getting ejected in game 6, you know, in 2005. And we had what I have thought in many ways was the seminal moment. And one of the seminal moments, certainly in the career of Paul Pierce, it happened right in front of me back in the good old days when we could actually see the games and we were, you know, courtside and could be involved, was after 2 months of clashing, you know, in Doc Rivers' first year, and Doc Rivers came in with that 5-year contract, which is very significant, and Paul Pierce had been able to run amok. He was the kid who was able to do whatever he wanted when Jim O'Brien was here, because Jim O'Brien had no choice, by the way. You know, that was going to be the way it was. So there was that moment I feel strongly it was against Milwaukee, but my memory I can get old guy on it really quick. But it was a late November, early December game, and Doc had had enough, and he yanked him out of the game. And as Paul Pierce is coming out, they had words right in front of me. If you go back and watch the tape of it, you could see me flip my, you know, one ear off of my headphones so I could, because I knew something was happening between those two. And it was just that moment of, it was that parent-child moment of, no, this is going to be the way you do it.
What were the words? We're on a podcast. You can say the words if you want.
But I don't actually. And you know what? It's funny because as time goes by. But it was about whose team it is and about who's playing. There weren't words. There were glares. It wasn't. You know, there was sort of the muttering to each other.
Uh-huh.
I took the ear flap off because I said, "This is a moment. It is significant." And I remember going on Sports Tonight. I think the next night, and watching. They had the tape of it, and you could see me. Like leaning, you know, E.F. Hutton, if you're old enough to remember that one.
I do.
Listen, Google it. As I say to Max all the time when he talks about Bonanza or whatever, I'm Google it, kids. Google it. You know, that's the beauty of the internet. So at that moment, and it went on, you know, back and forth that year. But, of course, Paul came back the next year. And it's what I've always thought I was waiting for Carmelo Anthony to have that kind of year, you know, that, that moment where it all clicks and he kind of comes back together and whatever. But he was, you know, he came back that next year, and even though the team was not good around him, and that was the team that ended the playoff streak, that was the first year I'd been in the league with the team that did not make the playoffs, because I'd been with Garnett in Minnesota for 3 years and then 4 years in Boston. And that 06 team, but he was just phenomenal that entire year, you know, start to finish. He had, you know, it wasn't an MVP year, because obviously you don't win the MVP when your team doesn't make the playoffs, but he was, he had turned the corner, was clearly ready to be that guy. And he was being that guy again the next year when then he got hurt and everything went crazy south. We're in the 10th anniversary, right, as we talk right now. I've been sort of documenting it a little bit just for kicks, because we know next year we'll be documenting the 10th anniversary of everything good that happened. We're in the 10th anniversary right now of the 18-game losing streak, which included, infamously, as soon as that was over on the radio side, it included we'll be commemorating the Violet Palmer, Max.
Oh, geez.
10th anniversary of one of the great. I learned a lot, you know, that time will come and we'll talk about it then, but that's a life experience. I learned a lot about the media during that ordeal. But, you know, Paul Pierce during that time, and he came back and he played hard and he played as well as he could, and he was clearly ready to be that guy. And it was a turning point that, you know, and Doc is, say whatever you want about Doc. Somebody asked me today, you think if in hindsight Doc would have, knowing what was going to happen with the Celtics here, that maybe he would? I'm like, nope, didn't even let him finish. Nope, there was no way he could do this. There was no way. This was not, this Doc Rivers was the perfect guy to go to L.A. and deal with the Donald Sterling stuff. And I say this, he's someone that is, I consider, a very close friend. And we were very, very close when he was here. And obviously, you know, when you're working 3,000 miles apart, it isn't the same. But he's someone who was important, very important to me. And I say this as his friend, as someone who admires him, as someone who, you know, we became close over those years. He could not do this. This was not, he needs that microphone on his lapel on TNT on Thursday night. You know, that's the world he's, you take that away from him. You put him on Tuesday night in a rebuilding year against Sacramento, he's a fish out of water. He can't breathe. There's no oxygen for him in that world. Doc was the perfect guy to go to LA, as it turned out, and Brad was the perfect guy to do this.
So then with Doc in LA, and here they are kind of at a their own transition, just to go down the sidebar a little bit, does that work against him? Because he's now in charge. He doesn't have Danny Ainge, and we know that Danny Ainge is as level-headed as it comes when it comes to being a GM. But if Doc can't do the Tuesday night thing, and he's looking at Chris Paul and Blake Griffin and DeAndre Jordan and their varying places in their careers, is he going to make bad decisions? I don't want you to call it your friend, but like this is the position that he's in.
I don't know. I think that the coach GM thing is very tough to do. I would think that Doc could be Doc. This is what I believe about Doc. He'd be great at whatever he set his mind to being great at. But I think it's really tough to be a general manager and a coach. That's a lot of, you know, checks and balances in there. And Doc's really good about asking other people. You know, he's not a, you know, voice in an ivory tower. It's going to be my way. Like, he literally will, if he's interested in the player, he'll text his friends around the league, and he'll, you know, he's diligent in everything he does. I think he got a bad rap for that for a variety of reasons, about not, you know, not living here and flying back to see Austin play in high school and all the, you know, all the stuff he did with his kids. When he had as much time to work, he probably had more time to work on those flights that he was taking back and forth than, you know, that's all he did during those flights back and forth to go watch his kids play. So as hard a working guy as there is, I think he would figure it out. I think that's in this day and age with the complexities of everything, pretty tough to do both.
Right. And which means that he clearly he does not want to go through a rebuild. He does
no,
not.
And I think he will. If the answer to the question is, will he scratch and claw to keep this thing together and keep it moving at a high level and trade away the future? Well, now the Clippers have a ton of stuff to trade away for the future. I think he would be that guy to keep it, you know, to keep it going. Nobody wants to, generally speaking, nobody wants to. Do you think Celtics fans want to do it? in 2013, you think anybody else wanted to jump into the, you know?
No, nobody wants to go full Sam Hinkie on anybody.
But this is
relevant to the Boston Celtics. It's not just a Doc sidebar. This is Danny Ainge. Now we're talking about Carmelo Anthony, and Carmelo Anthony would waive his no trade clause for, you know, only certain people, only certain teams. And if Doc is sitting there saying I might trade for Carmelo, and to rope Paul Pierce back into this conversation. If it's somehow getting Blake and Paul Pierce for, you know, in a facilitate a three-team trade, I don't know that Doc's going to do that. He's not going to give up a huge piece of what already works to get an unknown into Los Angeles. So our listeners for Celtics fans who are sitting there like, can we get in on a Melo to the Clippers trade? A Melo to the Clippers trade, unless Phil Jackson is completely hell-bent on moving on from the Carmelo Anthony era and smoking whatever the hell he is smoking out there, that he doesn't take back a Chris Paul or Blake Griffin or something big, that's just not going to happen. So unless there's a big cataclysmic shift in Phil Jackson's thinking, Celtics fans should probably not expect to get in on some sort of Clippers deal, because that Doc Rivers is just not going to do that.
I think we're meandering to, we're not there yet. And I think something still could happen, but we're meandering pretty close to the Carmelo's kind of untradeable, and it has to do with his contract and what you have to give to get in return, because there's a lot of teams, and this is a smaller example, but Stephon Marbury late in his contract. That was a player a lot of people would like to have, including the Celtics in 2009. I said when they got him, he'd win them a playoff game, and he did, game five against Orlando. But it was a matter of nobody would – if Carmelo Anthony was bought out tomorrow, there'd be 20 teams lining up to add Carmelo Anthony. But it's too difficult with what you'd have to give up to get him. And listen, would Carmelo Anthony – I know people – a lot of people shuddered this off. I'm a pro Carmelo guy. I like Carmelo. I know as a lifelong holder of minority opinions, that's another one. To me, Carmelo is almost like he'd be great on the Celtics as like the sixth man. He'd be great backing up Jay Crowder. You know, there's a lineup. You know, we're forgetting salaries, what you're giving up, all the other stuff for a second. Just putting it aside, how would you use Carmelo on this roster? Because if you're asking me, I love Carmelo. But I'm not giving up Jay Crowder. I'm not giving up Marcus Smart. I would prefer not to give up Avery Bradley. Like, I think the team is better as is. If you just added Carmelo and you could do it for giving up some of those contracts we're talking about at the end of the bench, the Celtics would have a lethal, have Carmelo as your sixth man, or have a lethal lineup that had Carmelo at the four, Jay Crowder at the three, and Horford at the five. How are you going to stop that lineup? With Isaiah and one of the other guards. Like, Carmelo can still do some things, but what do you have to give up with his, you know, and the trade kicker on top of it, on top of the 20, you know, it's just one of those. Marbury suddenly, when he got bought out, when Marbury was available, everybody was lining up. But it was, you can't, at $25 million or whatever Marbury was making back then, it was untradeable.
Right. Carmelo holds all the cards. And if he's happy, or he and his wife are happy in New York, then why bother moving? And if LA is the only other option, he's not going to play for the Lakers. They don't care to move anybody for him. He doesn't fit their plans. It's the Clippers or nothing. So it's New York, LA, or nothing. And it just, I feel like it's going to be nothing with Carmelo. So the pipe dream of getting Paul Pierce back here in some sort of blockbuster trade as a three-team, blah, 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 that's just not going to happen. All right, before we wrap it up.
I'm with you.
I just kind of want to bring back just the Paul Pierce one last thing. I remember seeing this comedian once who said, he came out and he's just talking matter-of-factly. He said, you know, I've never been an alcoholic. I've never done drugs. And silence. And he just turned to the audience and said, see? If I had said I was a recovering alcoholic or recovering addict, you all would have applauded. And for Paul Pierce, in the NBA sense, he was such a lost cause. In that moment where you flipped your earpiece off and they were fighting for control of the team, Paul Pierce was on the verge of just being that petulant, just go for mine – and fade into NBA obscurity as a high-scoring brat. When he
I think that's fair, and I think what you're saying is, which I've said for many, many years, as a society, we value those who royally screw up and pay a price for it, as opposed to the people that never screw up.
So is that why we love Paul Pierce so much, beyond the championship, beyond everything?
I think your view is dead on, but I don't think it's what the majority of people think of. I just think they think of him as someone who grew up in front of our eyes. I said this many times, that one of the best parts about this job for me was watching him go from that kid, and I never had an issue with him. We never had it. We always got along great, even when he was the petulant child on the court, you know, which is probably overstating it, but it makes good copy. He was someone who grew up watching him become the man he became and has become, and the father, and someone who looked out for other players and took care of his money and whatever. That, to me, was one of the most rewarding, just watching him evolve, because like most of these guys, he ended up, we're talking about things, we have this conversation about these things he was doing and going through. He was 25 years old when this was happening. And by the way, it's not the only wearing the Jacob Marley thing after game five and arguing with Doc. That's not the biggest ordeal that Paul Pierce went through. His ordeal came at a nightclub several years earlier and survived by inches. So, you know, I think it was that, and giving all the years to Boston, even when the team wasn't that good, to become one of those guys and then to eventually have success. And, you know, even if he was, again, a dirty little secret, but even if he was the number two guy on that team and winning the championship, to have that moment, you know, to go through all that, I don't know if it's redemption as much as reward for all the years he gave. And I think leaving in a way that he obviously didn't want to leave, and it made the team better in doing it. It was the perfect scenario for both Pierce and Garnett to leave the way they did. And it's what separates Ray Allen in that debate. At some point after Pierce and Garnett get their numbers retired, that is going to be a heated debate, is the Ray Allen conversation.
That's an entirely different conversation.
Yeah, sure is.
Yeah. Do you know what you're going to say in your open on Sunday?
No, I don't. I will, and it's funny because it's one of those games, a little inside baseball stuff, but when ABC, our pregame show, and I don't do that much anymore except for the big games, because it became like a hobby of mine to do it, just because I didn't have anywhere else to write. Now there's plenty of time when you have two full-time jobs and a five-year-old son, you don't have as much time as you used to have, to do those for every game. I try to do it when it's a big game. When you're on ABC, our pregame show, from the time it starts to the time the ball goes in the air, is 40 minutes on a regular night. So half of that is commercials. You know, you got the Brad Stevens thing, you have Around the NBA, you got headlines from the, you know, back at the station. So there's not a ton of content. When ABC comes in, the game doesn't start at 10 after the hour. It starts at 2 minutes after the hour. So instead of 20 minutes of content and 20 minutes of commercials or promos or opens, it becomes 12 minutes of content. Mm-hmm. You got to. I think it might be 0-5 Sunday because there's no doubleheader because of the Super Bowl, so we may have a little more wiggle room. But it's much harder on those games to devote time to it. But I haven't thought about it yet. Obviously, I did one for Rondo. I did big ones for Pierce and Garnett when they first came back. I try not to. I don't polish those. I do them when I write something out, whether it's for something like that or doing the MMA stuff. When I do a fighter's walk, I don't sit there and tweak it and write it several times or whatever. I just do what comes to my mind, write it, and then the only thing I have to edit it for is time, because there's only, you know, you only have so much time for a fighter to walk down the stage to the cage. You only have as much time for, you know, in an open for a game. It has to be a certain length. So I try not to get overly, you know, if people always ask me about the calls at the end, the only time I've ever had a call in my head, I had no choice. The call would have been completely different if the Celtics won, as I still to this day can't believe they didn't win in game five in 2008 in L.A. It would have been much different than what it turned out to be. And what it turned out to be, all of a sudden it was in my head, because at halftime that game was over. So I literally, it was like an hour and a half that you knew the Celtics were going to win. That, I mean, we all knew they were going to win that night anyway, but it was, you know, a 20-point game at halftime. So you actually had, you couldn't, there was an element of spontaneity that was taken out of it by the fact that there was no spontaneity, you know, in the game. There was no, the outcome was not in doubt.
And right.
Thankfully, we had the only spontaneous thing that could possibly happen was Big Baby throwing the ball up in the air and Max catching it and nobody having his microphone potted down.
That was fantastic.
That would be a 30 for 31 day just by itself. It's the story of how Max's mic ended up and how I didn't know it was. I heard it like everybody else, but I didn't know, again, a little broadcasting inside baseball, there are things you hear in your ear that are not on the air.
Right.
People can talk to you. There's something called in queue where you're here. So at the moment, the reason I kept going was there was a possibility, and God knows I was hoping and praying, that wasn't on the air. I didn't know whether it was on the air. I had no visual contact with Max. I couldn't see him because he was lost in the crowd. So I kept going in the hopes that did not get on the air. And even as I was saying those words, I said, if that's on the air, that is Max. Max will have, that'll be his thing for the rest of his
such
life.
A fun moment. But, oh, good stuff. All right.
Even better was, actually the better moment was in game 6 in Detroit when Max kind of got emotionally involved during those games in the playoff run and the championship run in 08. And in game 6, you remember the seminal moment of game 6 on the road in Detroit. And I had a gut feeling. I remember gambling with my open for that game that I kind of went with the one that I thought was going to be the winning. I thought they were going to win that night, even though they hadn't won on the road on the playoffs. I just felt like it. And I remember going with the open that I thought would have been for the clinching game. But the seminal moment was a crazy scramble with the Celtics missing a bunch of shots, but getting offensive rebounds when they were making that comeback in the fourth quarter. And eventually, Posey misses a shot. Somebody else missed a shot. And the ball comes out, and Paul wins the race, and he has the offensive rebound out near half court. Rip Hamilton is sneaking up from behind him. And Max, in the heat of the moment, goes, "Paul, look out!" I mean, it was unbelievable. Like, he completely he totally lost his mind in that moment because he got so emotionally involved. That, to me, was better than the, you know.
It's just a player warning his teammate. That's basically what it boiled down to.
He became a different.
He went back to cornbread on the floor. That's what he went back to.
He totally did. And he was in Game 7 in 2010 because he was the Lakers, and he hated the Lakers, and you'll see him. Max will be featured prominently, I promise you, in the 30 for 30 coming up this summer from ESPN about the Lakers. And he still to this day hates them and still, you know, has this thing with Matt. You know, Magic was running around Game 7, and it was like Max was already – he was really getting upset when that lead was sort of evaporating. But great moments. And well, once someday when Max retires from broadcasting, I can tell you all these stories.
I look forward to that. Maybe we can get a Locked On Celtics exclusive.
With was Paul Pierce in 2003 broke Max's record for free throws. Celtic single season free throw record.
Uh-huh.
And at the time, again, we were courtside everywhere. And I started a countdown. And Paul, then this is the young, petulant child, kind of playful one who, in addition, you know, we're talking about bad stuff, but he would also do things like have the shooting contest with Moondog, the mascot in Cleveland, and stuff that you don't necessarily, an older professional doesn't do, but he did a lot of that. When he was, go back and watch these tapes, when he was making those free throws, he would look back at us. He'd make one and look back at Max and I. And I was, again, younger as I was, I would hold up the number that he needed to break the record. Like, he would look back and I would hold up a 5 and he would give Max a sneer. And then, you know, make another free throw. So there's all kinds of, you know, you have individual experiences with Paul over the years, just traveling and, you know, like personal stuff. But that was just in game. You know, it was a much different situation when we were on the floor, you know, interacting with everybody.
Someday we'll talk. That's a great conversation to have about the mentality of a player at the level of Paul Pierce, at the level of Cedric Maxwell and other guys. Because fans don't necessarily understand that mentality and the supreme confidence and the, I guess, like in that situation you're just talking about, that little rivalry that develops, like, hey, I'm going for your record. Like, that's a special kind of thing. I'm going to let you go because we've spoken for an hour and I'm not going to keep you any longer. But that'll be a conversation that we have, because personally, I love that stuff. I love the human element of the game, and I love those things that piss players off, that motivate players, the things that piss Isaiah Thomas off, and that you and I, or maybe just me, I don't know about you, we might say they're just kind of like brush off. Just say, I always say, to be a Paul Pierce or a Kobe Bryant or a Larry Bird or a LeBron, like, you have to have almost like a mental kind of, for lack of a better term, deficiency. You can't be normal.
Well, I'll leave you this. First of all, I don't, because if you don't think I make a note of who the national guy is to come to a Celtics game, that I'm trying to outperform whoever it is that's doing the, I mean, you have to find, if you're at all competitive, you have to find motivation. That, you know, and you do this a lot of years as I've been doing it, sometimes that's hard to do. So, yeah, do I know who's doing the game on tomorrow for ESPN? Do I know who's doing it for ESPN Radio on Sunday? Do I know who's doing it for ABC? Yeah, I know all that stuff because everybody internally, if you have any sense of crazy, sick competitiveness, Max's favorite story about me as a kid was whenever we'd play Monopoly with my family, if I had Park Place and somebody landed on Boardwalk, they wouldn't buy it because it wasn't worth ruining the night of, you know, me having a temper tantrum of, you know, being overly competitive. Like, he loves that story. He thinks it's the greatest story of all time because it obviously encapsulates me and the person that, you know, I've sort of grown into. But Isaiah's running out of stuff, isn't he? Pretty soon it's going to be like, you know, the hotel mattress didn't have a tag on it. They don't respect it. You know, he's running
out. It's
true. He's all-star, perennial all-star. Again, we'll save this for another time, but I was with him. We talked about this in the interview last night. I was with him and Brian Dew, our strength coach. We went to TNT when we were in Atlanta, and just to have really his first experience around Kevin Garnett, who obviously I know very well from all the years. It was really something to watch Isaiah. I probably spent more time with Isaiah that night than I have, you know, in any setting, one sitting in the couple of years he's been here. And it was really, you know, interesting to see him soaking all this in, because he knows full well where he is, and, you know, things happen fast. Oh, you don't know how fast it happens and where you are, and it goes, but he knows. He absolutely knows what's happening right now,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the big picture.
Let me ask you this. I got to ask this one question then, since we're here. Is this competitive nature of yours, is this why you work so much?
Probably. Because
you do everything. You've probably called three games already today, as far as I'm...
I think that you have to, you know, it's a dangerous, and I would say this to anybody that wants to be a broadcaster or whatever, if you're an extremely competitive person, broadcasting and play-by-play is a dangerous outlet because, as you know, without going too far down this road, it doesn't work like sports. The best people aren't always, there are many other factors that determine who does what and when and why and how. So I always knew because, you know, I wasn't anybody's son. I wasn't anybody's, you know, whatever. I knew that I had to take the talent I had, and the one thing that I could control is working harder than everybody else to be as good as I could be at it. And it's hard now sometimes when you've done – this is a job when you've done this job as long as I've done it, and I've seen it happen. You can go two ways with it because I could show up. I could phone this job in and still be – you know, we still have good broadcasts if I didn't do the work that I do. But I don't see the job is too important, you know.
Yeah.
And you don't want to lose that edge. And, you know, Twitter has created a new world. Obviously, I got nagged into doing it at first, but it allows a lot of the stuff that I do. I like it because it supplements. I can do TV. You know, I came from TV, so I can do TV graphics on Twitter for people who listen to the broadcast and follow along. That's what a lot of the stuff I do is. It's TV graphics that I can't, just doesn't make sense to read them on radio. It's a, you know, it's a way to sort of supplement it. And the reality is, you know, radio, our audience is fiercely loyal, but we never know how big it is. And I reach, you know, once things start bouncing around Twitter, I reach far more people through that on social media and Twitter than I do, you know, during the broadcast. I know that from reaction that I get. So, you know, I'll say something. I'll make a very strong comment. It doesn't get one-tenth of the reaction. If I make the same comment on Twitter, it's just a different...
Right, because I follow you on Twitter like every Celtics fan should. I'm watching the game on television, but I'm reacting to you on Twitter, so you get the whole audience. This has been a great conversation, and I feel like this is a conversation that only just started. So I know this is your second time on the podcast.
Probably best we didn't have Jay here. He would have ruined it.
He probably would have. Again, back to the beginning, just to kind of tie this whole thing together. It's you know, we'll bring him along. He'll be fine. He'll be fine, but you know, he'll be.
Do you know how disheartening it is for him? He comes up with, like, he's sitting there doing the games, and he's trying to come up with a stat or some whatever. And then I've tweeted it before him, and I beat him by 30 seconds. And he'll say something like, oh, well, you know what, yeah, you beat me by 30 seconds, but I had it too. And I'm like, dude, I'm calling the game while I'm doing this. You're just sitting there. That's your job. I'm beating you at your job, and I'm doing my job. Like, come on, you got, like, be better. So that's... if I can push these kids, you know, just a little bit, to work a little harder, be a little better, then I've left a little legacy behind.
Just keep pushing him, man. Keep pushing him. He needs to grow. This has been great, Sean. I really appreciate this. This has been a great conversation. We're going to have to continue this at some point. Thank you very much for coming on to the show.
Hey, anyone that's listening, obviously you're a hardcore Celtics fan. This is why we do, you know, what we do. I appreciate everything that you guys do. And, you know, there's new media, there's old media, there's anyone that advances the conversation. And I'm all for it. It's the least I can do.
Well, it's a pleasure, and I always enjoy talking to you here and the few instances we have a chance to meet in person. So thanks again, and we will chat later. Thank you.
You got it.
Man, I could have just gone on forever with Sean Grandy there. I didn't want to hold him past the hour, but, and you probably don't want to listen for 3 hours, but I could have talked to him for another couple of hours easily. Amazing stuff. And this whole concept of Isaiah Thomas essentially being a human YouTube video, amazing. The fact that his size is almost kind of an advantage, that's just, I do believe that. I think that at this point, stop thinking of Isaiah Thomas' size as like something that's holding him back offensively. He's learned how to use that as a very effective weapon, and he gets away with a lot, and he uses it to his advantage, no doubt about it. The Paul Pierce stuff, I mean, his evolution, that stuff is great. We talked a lot about Paul Pierce. That I could talk about him all day. I was fascinated by the Doc Rivers stuff. And how he's going to handle things out in Los Angeles. So a great, great, great conversation with Sean Grandy. Really thanks to him again for joining the show. He's one of those people that I could just talk to forever and just brings out my absolute basketball nerddom because I love talking about this stuff. So great show, I think. Even if you didn't think so, I thought so. I'd rate this show 5 stars. I hope you do too. And I hope you are a subscriber. If you haven't, please do subscribe. Listen to the rest of the Locked On Podcast Network. The Celtics play the Lakers on Friday night. A chance to pass the Lakers in all-time regular season wins. So check out the Locked On Lakers podcast. They're one of the cornerstone shows in this network along with us. They do great work. Check out Locked On Clippers. They're going to be talking about the show, talking about the game ahead of this Sunday with Paul Pierce coming back. Locked On NBA, Locked On Fantasy, just a bunch of great shows all throughout the network. It's a great network. As an NBA fan, it's something you should be listening to and working into your regular routine. Again, thank you for making us part of your daily routine. We'll be back on Monday. Hopefully, and look, if you're a Patriots fan, go Patriots. If you're not, we'll just have to put this aside. I'm a Boston guy. I'm going all Pats. Forget everything else. Thanks for listening. This has been the Locked On Celtics podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.